Welcome to Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. Today, I am chatting with Dr. Douglas A. Parry about media psychology. Douglas is an assistant professor at Freie University in Amsterdam and a researcher in socioinformatics, specifically in communication science, human computer interaction, and media psychology. Welcome, Douglas. I'm so delighted to have you on board.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Douglas, before we get chatting about the work you do, can you tell me a little bit more about who you are, what you do, and what that pivot point was that got you down the road or sent you down the road of what's known in Europe as media psychology, but known in other places as cyber psychology?
Sure. So I've always been interested in technology and the online world. And as a teenager, I spent many hours exploring early social media platforms like MySpace and other online forums and things like that. And I started programming at a relatively young age, and I attended quite a forward-thinking school where technology was front and center. This was early 2000s. We had laptops in classes. We had smart boards, things like that. So for the longest time, I thought that I was going to be an engineer or a software developer. And that's actually what I first studied, a degree in mechatronic engineering. But I quickly realized that that something was missing here. And both my parents are clinical psychologists. My dad's a professor. So conversations about human behavior, psychology, the world around us. And I found myself drawn to this intersection between people and technology. So I pivoted to a program called socioinformatics at Stellenbosch University in South Africa. And this program at the time was quite unique because it combined elements of communication science, information systems, computer science, quite technical, as well as things like psychology. So this allowed me to bring together my technical interests and my technical background and expertise, I guess, with my interests in people, media, and society. At the time, though, I did think that I'd probably still use this interdisciplinary background to go work in maybe app development or software development, perhaps something like UX or user experience design or app design. But during my honors year, I was working on a research project where I developed an app which was designed to improve the user experience for navigating load shedding schedules, which is rolling blackouts in South Africa. They're a major challenge where we didn't have electricity for many hours. And I suppose if any, this project was maybe the pivot point, the turning point. I realized that I was actually far more interested in understanding how people use technology or how the technology might impact their lives or their behavior than actually developing any kind of apps or technology in its own right. And in publishing a conference paper about this project, I also realized that I really enjoyed doing the research and actually researching people and technology and the intersections there.
And you did a master's in UX, specifically in usability testing around attention, distraction, and multitasking, which you based on Nicholas Carr's book, The Shallows. Can you just explain a little bit more about what UX is and usability testing?
Sure. So UX or user experience, it's essentially about understanding how people interact with apps, software, any kind of digital product, really, and figuring out how to make those interactions as intuitive, efficient, and as enjoyable as possible. And usability testing, that's one part of the methods that you might use in UX. And it essentially involves observing how real actual users engage with a product or a platform or a service to try and identify pain points or areas for improvement. And my honors research, this is the fourth year of university in South Africa, focused specifically on these aspects, on developing and evaluating apps and software to ensure that they met users' needs effectively. But actually, during my master's, my focus shifted a bit, as you said, to things like attention, distraction, multitasking with technology. And my supervisor at the time, he introduced me to Nicholas Carr's book, The Shallows, which had come out, I think it was about the year before I started my master's, around then. And this is a book that essentially looks at how the internet was, or what people thought the internet was, reshaping our brains and affecting our ability to concentrate and be distracted and so on. And at the time, therefore, my master's, this inspired me to study attention, distraction, and multitasking, specifically in relation to digital environments, digital platforms, our use of smartphones and social media. And it's interesting now to look sort of in retrospect, because while I tend to disagree with many of Carr's takes now, it's 10 years on, we know a lot more about what the actual empirical evidence says. At the time, I was very interested in understanding how people multitask with technology, how this affects our short-term performance. So specifically, I was focusing on students in lectures or trying to study and being distracted. It's obviously still a very important topic, as well as then also Carr's idea of, you know, living in the shallows of these kind of longer-term, more sustained effects at the time on our abilities to concentrate.
That's very interesting that you said 10 years on. And I think that's a lot of the research that we do. Everything changes so quickly that we kind of, it's a small section of information that we find out. And we evolve or learn more, we find out new things. So it is such a really rapidly evolving field, and especially with new technology coming on board as well.
Definitely. I mean, findings from 20 years ago, sure, there are some seminal findings, some seminal theories that probably still might hold, still might replicate. But there's this idea of social media being a moving target problem, where what we called social media 20 years ago when I was in high school is not social media from 10 years ago, and is not social media today, and won't be social media in 10 years' time. So our theories need to evolve, the platforms, the environments we're studying needs to evolve, as well as also the methods that we can use to study this has evolved and will continue to need to evolve. That said, there is a bit of a push to try and not have our findings be so ephemeral, to try be a field, whether it's media psychology or cyber psychology, where we can have findings that don't become outdated within 5 years. So you're not specifically talking about this one feature on Facebook in 2015. It's about maybe it's affordances or certain higher level ways of thinking about features, affordances, or platforms, so that your findings can maybe stand the test of time, or at least last a little bit longer.
Yeah, I think that's the key, is to do research that stands the test of time, and because it's and we do need also to be careful about taking research from 10 years ago and applying it directly to current day situations. And we'll talk a little bit about that a little later. There's a research paper that we're going to chat about that we spoke about in the initial conversation that we can explore later. So in terms of your master's research on usability and testing, what can you talk about what the top line findings were from your master's research?
Sure. So one of the key findings from my master's research, again, this is now nearly 10 years. I suppose I finished about 7-8 years ago. So again, that caveat maybe still applies here. But one of the key ideas here was this idea of cycles of self-regulation failure. So I was studying students' use of technology and how it interacts with attention, but also looking at some of the reasons why we might multitask, even if we know that it's potentially harmful to our performance. So we're trying to study, we're trying to concentrate on lecture. You might want to do well in your degree and get a job, or pass your course at the very least. Yet students engage in behavior that they know is potentially detrimental to that. So one of the key ideas was this idea of cycles of self-regulation failure. And I looked at how students in these academic settings, studying at home or studying in a library or in a class, often struggle with this goal conflict. So there's this tension between the immediate short-term rewards that digital media offer us. So looking at a funny meme from friends on WhatsApp, or a quick Instagram reel, or I suppose reels weren't out at the time, Facebook or a YouTube video or something like that, the instant reward that you can get from that activity, compared to the more longer-term rewards of focusing on your studies, passing that test, graduating, getting a job, whatever these goals are. And there's this idea that there's this goal conflict, this constant sort of struggle where you need to decide in this moment, am I going to concentrate and make some notes on this chapter, or am I going to look at my phone and send a WhatsApp message to my friends? And you need to students need to regulate their behavior to align with these longer term goals. And the research seems to suggest that these digital distractions, though potentially small in the moment, it can add up, and there can be goal neglect, procrastination, distraction, which can, of course, affect academic performance and well-being and things like that down the line. So my master's research focused on this idea of this goal conflict that students go into, as well as how they rationalize that, how they think about that, or whether they do even think about that. In many cases, some of these things happen automatically, where people haven't really thought about what is the actual implication of this behavior or not. Some of the consequences of this media-driven procrastination, goal neglect. And then in my PhD research, I started focusing on if people are aware of this, what are some of the ways in which they can try manage these distractions or mitigate the potential effects on distractions? They can maybe foster a healthier relationship with technology to get the good out of it. I'm certainly not in favor of things like bans and so on, and maybe we'll get to that later. But I think having a more sort of active, proactive relationship with technology to mitigate distractions while still having it around when you need it was something that I started to look at during my PhD.
I like that cycles of self-regulation behavior, because it's kind of, I think we often beat ourselves up when we distract ourselves from something we really need to get done. And then we find ourselves a couple of hours later not having done what we really need to do. So is that what you talk about, or what do you mean when you talk about cycles of self-regulation behaviors, getting us to the point where we are able to self-regulate in terms of the multimedia activity that we're doing?
Yeah. So if I remember, this is again now sort of eight, 9 years ago, but the idea was that there's this goal conflict. We've got this immediate reward and we've got this longer term reward that you need to to work a bit harder on to concentrate. And the research sort of identified these patterns that students tend to find themselves in, where they want to go and study, they want to spend an hour working through some material, and they find that after 10 minutes they open their phone. This is now 10 years ago, so probably Instagram, maybe Twitter, Snapchat was maybe around then, and they would go and do whatever it was, and then 5 minutes later they say, well, I was already on my phone. I'll go look at that again. So this tended, they described these cycles that they would find themselves in, and this inability to almost break out of the cycle and then spend 30 minutes or an hour working through whatever materials that they needed to do. And so we were looking at these experiences that students find themselves in, these patterns of not actually wanting to go on their phone, but without even thinking about it, 10 minutes later, they've automatically opened their phone, unlocked it, or typed in a sequence of INST or whatever to go to a particular website. And they find themselves doing this action that they didn't necessarily want to be doing while studying.
And I think that's true of us as grown-ups in the working world, that we do the same thing, especially if we've got a really big task ahead of us. And sometimes we kind of go and have a look at a website or go look at social media just to almost distract ourselves from the big task we really have to do, and the amount of cognitive load that we know is going to be involved in that really complicated task.
Definitely. Media for procrastination is a major topic of research.
So let's delve a little bit more into your PhD research, where you focused on the cognitive psychology side of things, particularly around media multitasking and self-regulation techniques to enhance digital well-being, which you've mentioned. So what is media tasking, and what does the research tell us about short and long-term effects on our attention?
Sure. So it was sort of the logical next steps, I guess, after my master's was a PhD project now. Looking more specifically at the kind of cognitive effects of this repeated patterns of fragmented media use, or the term we tended to use or has been used over the last 15 years is media multitasking, which is basically the practice of using multiple different forms of media simultaneously. So scrolling through Instagram while watching a TV show, or checking an email during an online meeting, or while you are studying, also messaging on WhatsApp, whatever it might be. It's this idea of either simultaneously or switching back and forth between different media activities. And again, we tend to look at the short-term effects there of these digital distractions and how that affects task performance in the moment. And research is fairly clear that in the moment, not spending time working, maybe it's a job, or maybe you're a student concentrating in a class, in a lecture, or while studying, you are rapidly switching. There's switch costs associated with that, as well as just the time displacement of not actually concentrating on what you're needing to do has effects on your performance, on your academic performance, your retention, and so on. But then going back to the idea of Nicholas Carr and so on, there's also this idea that's been around for about 15 years, that are there longer term effects of this? This idea of constantly being in this fragmented attention, constantly multitasking, does that train or mitigate or lead us to a particular kind of mode of attentional performance? This idea of not being able to sustain reading a full novel or a book, or constantly feeling distracted, or that you can't actually concentrate as long as you used to be. So this idea of these kind of impacts on what we call our cognitive control. And cognitive control is essentially the The mental processes that allow us to focus, to prioritize tasks, to inhibit distractions, and manage all these different competing demands on our attention, essentially, through things like working memory, inhibitory control, and so on. And what's interesting is this idea is fairly established that our attention spans have weakened over the last 15 years. But the evidence is actually fairly inconsistent. It's fairly weak. It's quite a difficult thing to study. And there's major individual differences. There's contextual factors. There's some shortcomings in how this has been theorized. And there's also key methodological challenges to actually being able to investigate this. Despite that, despite these uncertainties, there's this idea. And given the idea that we are potentially either in the moment distracted or our ability to concentrate is affected, there's a growing body of research that now tries to focus on the policies as well as just the practices that people can do to mitigate and to manage these digital distractions, regardless of what the evidence says for sustained effects. And quite a lot of the research in this area has focused on the self-regulation techniques that people can use to manage, to mitigate, to help them to concentrate. And there's a lot of different ideas about what self-regulation is, but essentially it's, broadly speaking, the capacity to align thoughts, behaviors, and actions with longer-term goals. So, the student sitting there needing to study, the longer-term goal is pass the test, graduate, get a job. The shorter-term reward is spending time on the phone, scrolling Instagram and seeing what your friends are doing or seeing what's happening on the media. And from a self-regulation perspective, the idea would be to align your behavior with the longer-term goals. And in theory, that should be studying to pass the test and so on. So in the context of digital well-being, this involves thinking about the strategies that people can use to prevent or mitigate these temptations to engage with whatever the digital technology is. And there's a huge variety of different strategies that people have looked at. This could be from as simple as studying in a distraction-free environment. So, putting your phone on the other side of the room or in a different room, there's a lot of research around that. It could be, turning off notifications, airplane mode. What a lot of researchers focus on is what we call digital self-control tools. So that's using apps to block certain platforms, either in general or for a given period in time, using different modes on your phone that turn off notifications from certain people. Or one of the interesting ways that I sort of started to look at with my PhD was this idea of design friction to make what we might think of as impulsive actions less impulsive or less automatic. So design friction is a concept that's sort of come from human-computer interaction, user experience, usability testing, and so on. And the idea there is to add some small barriers to encourage people to reconsider their actions. So essentially an action that would be automatic, and for many people that might be swiping open your phone, clicking on a certain app and going to a certain feed or something like that. It happens fairly automatically. Whereas with friction, it might be that when you open your phone, it introduces some kind of a delay. Or if you click on the Instagram or TikTok, whatever app button, it introduces a 5-second delay. And the idea is that in that moment, you're maybe rethinking, do I actually want to do this? Close the phone and do something else. And there's various tools and apps and websites and so on that can facilitate this. They require you to maybe retype your goal. And then if you retype your goal and still want to use it, then it allows you into the app or something like that. So in my PhD, I looked at some of these apps, things like Forest is a popular one where you grow a forest and you study using Pomodoro techniques of working for 25 minutes, then you can take a 5-minute break and you grow a tree. And if you open your phone within those 25 minutes and use it, you kill the tree and so on. So looking at how these things help people to concentrate and feel like they're sustaining their attention.
So it sounds like design friction is really about reducing automatic behavior and impulsive tendencies. So it's kind of making you stop and think, because we do generally operate on automatic behavior as much as possible to reduce the amount of energy that we consume in our behavior, which is a fascinating way of thinking about how we actually use digital technology. And I'm assuming self-regulation techniques are kind of quite individualistic in terms of what works for one person doesn't necessarily work for another.
Definitely. And that also makes it a challenge to study it, because you could have a technique that in general or sort of in its own right is effective, but it might be effective for a subset of people. What works for me might not work for you, or what works under certain circumstances maybe in the office might not be very effective when you're at home, or might not work for students and different things. So you've got to, if you're developing and testing these types of techniques as a researcher, or even just someone wanting to implement different practices for themselves to manage their own attention and distraction, it takes a bit of trial and error, and it's quite a tricky thing to work out what is actually going to work and when. And some of it also, what I identified in my PhD, if I sort of think now a couple of years back on this, was just the sheer awareness of one's attention. For many people, as you said, we go through life fairly automatically. And some of the things that I used, I used an app for participants in some of my studies where they had to just, this was now prior to screen time and things like that coming out, or maybe those types of apps had just come out. So people were fairly unsure or didn't really know how much time they were spending on their phones. And as part of one of the interventions that I had participants go through was just literally seeing how much time they spend on their phone in a given day and when, and also how that breaks down throughout the day. You know, these small 1 minute here, 2 minutes there, 5 seconds there, and so on. And I remember we did some quantitative analyses and some cognitive tasks and so on, but also interviews at the end. And I remember many participants were just shocked at, they didn't think they spent 2 hours or 3 hours on their phone. They thought, oh, you spend 45 minutes, or they didn't really realize all these little tiny instances throughout the day. So I think any kind of strategy, whatever it might be, does need to start with a degree of an awareness of what your behavior actually is and how that behavior aligns with what you might want it to be. I might want to use my phone in the morning, use it at lunch, use it at the end of the day. But I find that actually, if I look at the stats, I'm using it every 15 minutes, or you know, whatever the case might be. But there is also a risk, though, in thinking about some of these strategies as placing all of the onus on the individual. I think we do need to have a bit of balance here. Of course, I need to take responsibility for my attention. I need to take responsibility for my behavior, and I need to think of practices that allow me to achieve my goals, to do well in my work or my studies, whatever it might be. And I think there is a place for digital self-control tools. There is a place for screen time apps and things like that to learn about your behavior, to become aware of your behavior and take ownership. But at the same time, all the burden shouldn't be on individuals. I think there is a need, especially amongst platforms, policymakers, parents, schools, things like that, to design these tools and design these features to empower people, but also to create safer online environments or create situations in which we can learn these types of digital skills. I think managing your attention in relation to digital technologies is a key digital skill. And I do think that things like bans and so on kind of maybe don't allow us to develop these types of skills of maybe getting it wrong. Maybe you're in your first year at university where there's a little bit more freedom than high school normally, and you realize that I actually can't take my laptop to class, or my phone can't be in my pocket. It needs to be in my bag because I'm distracted for the first week or two. And then reflecting on that and developing a set of behaviors, you know, whatever it might be. I do think there's a role for policymakers, for platforms, parents, schools, teachers. There's a whole bunch of different people that need to be involved here, along with our own individual responsibility.
Doug, on that topic, last year there was obviously Australia brought in the social media ban, or the phone ban to children under 16. And you wrote a post last year titled "Social Media Ban Won't Solve Youth Mental Health Issues." Can you talk more about the points that you made around Australia banning young people from social media and what you think the solution may actually be?
Sure, definitely. I think it's not an easy topic, and there's also a lot of flamed opinions and ideas out there. And there's also just a lot of uncertainty as researchers, we're kind of going in blind here, where a lot of the research over the last 10, 15 years has unfortunately not enabled us to actually really understand what's going on. And maybe we'll talk about this later, but I do feel that we're in a bit of a position where it's our time to shine as researchers, to inform policy, inform practice, inform behavior. And we're a little bit let down by our empirical body of evidence. Nonetheless, the ban in Australia, it obviously mirrors other countries. We're seeing efforts in various states in the US, and I know there's many schools here in the Netherlands or in Belgium and South Africa as well that are looking to curb social media use amongst young people. And in this case, while there are of course concerns about distraction, mostly this is pushed by concerns about youth mental health and the potential effects of social media on anxiety, depression, stress, things like that amongst young people. And I do think that while these actions, these types of bans and so on might feel like common sense solutions, they do in many cases, firstly, oversimplify a massively complex issue here. Mental health is not a simple thing, and any kind of simple solution that is rushed into policy is definitely going to oversimplify that and miss probably backfire. I also think, as I mentioned earlier, this idea of fostering digital skills, that's really difficult to do in a banned environment. And I'm not sure if we any kind of ban or abstinence type approach here, whether it's social media or substances, alcohol, whatever the case might be, teenagers are teenagers. So I do think there's concerns there. And if you push behavior into the shadows, into the places where it's maybe whether if there's a ban or something's illegal, where parents or adults or teachers can't get involved because there's concerns around legality there, it becomes a very tricky issue. And I think if we reflect on this ban and what it might mean there, most research here on social media use and these bans tend to place almost exclusively, but a large amount of the blame for mental health challenges on social media. And it does tend to neglect these various individual factors, situational factors, contextual factors, economic, environmental factors, and so on. And while adolescents might face challenges online, they of course often do receive benefits, and we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater here. We can't ignore that this is not easy. And I think placing the blame for these declining mental health exclusively on social media does neglect trauma, family conflict, discrimination, poverty, lack of mental health support. And in this blog post, I sort of shaped it around a paper that Craig Sewell and I recently published in the Journal of Psychopathology and Clinical Science, in which we essentially ran a bit of a simulation idea, and we said let's take this to its fullest extent here, and let's take this idea that social media is exclusively or at least primarily responsible for declines in mental health, especially amongst young girls, and that tends to be the idea that is put forward in many popular science books and so on, and let's model that, but let's assume that in the real world, we have many things contributing to declines in mental health. We've got, as I said, things like discrimination, poverty, lack of mental health support, and so on. And we call these factors psychosocial adversity, as sort of a catch-all term for all this sort of bad stuff that essentially also plays a role in mental health. So we then said in this real world where lots of things affect mental health, and these things also interact with how you use social media. There's tends to be fairly reliable research that shows that people experiencing depression and anxiety and stress and so on, the way that they actually use social media differs from those who are not, whether for better or worse. And we simulated data under the assumption that this is what the world looks like. But then we applied the model that the simplified model of social media as cause. And to cut through the statistical kind of numbers part of the paper, essentially, we found that if you exclude these broader factors that contribute to mental health, you can find these sort of exaggerated effects for the role of social media, which then if you look at a lot of how research is conducted, that does tend to ignore these factors and then does tend to find these relationships with social media. We argue that there's potentially a bit of a confounding effect going on here where effects are found that might not actually exist in the real world. And this tends to be the case then if you look at these simplified arguments that are in a lot of the popular science books and in the media and so on, that it misses out all the other things that affect mental health. And this can lead to misguided policy solutions. It can lead to things like bans that in many cases might actually backfire and leave many policymakers and teachers and parents with this idea that, we've solved it. We've sorted out mental health. Meanwhile, many of the major causes of mental health challenges are neglected and underfunded, and the kind of resources are not put there there. So the root causes of mental health struggles are neglected, and social media is then used as a scapegoat.
I think that's the thing, is social media and phones are used as a scapegoat, and it's easy to put the blame on something that doesn't have a personality or is like, that's the cause. So therefore, if we ban it, then we've solved everything, but it's actually not really investigating everything around it. There's two things I want to chat to you about before we kind of get into what you're doing at Freya University. The first is, you mentioned during our initial conversation about an article called The Mere Presence of a Phone May Be Distracting. implications for attention, task performance. And I'd like to know why this was potentially misleading. And linked to that is you also touched during a conversation about a number of problems with original studies, especially around the quality of evidence. So I was kind of want to bundle those two questions into one in terms of, as an example of the mere presence of a phone maybe distracting, and why a lot of research or some research really is the quality of evidence isn't really there. You've touched on some of that already, but I'd really like to delve a bit more into that.
Sure. So sort of, I guess, throughout my PhD studies, I encountered many challenges, and I'm not unique in the sense related to the quality of evidence on digital media use and its effects. I found that many findings, even fairly seminal findings, were replicated. Now, of course, part of this could be, as we said in the beginning of the episode here, it could be to do with social media changing, individuals changing, society changing, and so on. But there's also part of it to do with, well, I started thinking about this during my PhD around how are we actually measuring social media use or smartphone use or laptop use, you know, whatever the media might be. What are these methods that we are using to study this? And I realized that both in the cognitive domain, so as we measure attention, but also in relation to well-being and attention and so on, most research has relied on estimates, essentially self-reports, to try and measure media use, and hasn't really maybe experimented. So in many domains, and you might start off with cross-sectional research where you conduct a survey and you find there's a correlation between X and Y, between social media and well-being, you know, whatever it might be. And then once you've sort of established that this correlation exists using fairly cheap and maybe not the greatest methods, you then head into an experimental paradigm where you can then start, you know, manipulating the behavior or measuring it in more robust ways or measuring the situational dynamics and so on. And that's starting recently, but at the time, this was now 4 or 5 years ago, it seemed that research in this area had been stuck for 10 years in using these cross-sectional methods, large surveys, and fairly unreliable measures of media use. So I saw this and I saw that, you know, most studies are asking participants to recall their behaviors. You know, how many minutes do you spend on your smartphone per day? How many times do you open Facebook on an average day or in a typical week? How long are you using your phone? Different things like that. And it's fairly well established in the behavioral sciences that self-reports or estimates reflect what people believe they do, their perceived behavior, rather than their actual behavior. So people aren't that good at accurately estimating highly frequent or habitual activities like digital media use. And if that's what most studies are using to study this phenomenon, that's a bit of a problem. So this is now 4 or 5 years ago, along with some colleagues during the pandemic, we conducted a meta-analysis on this basis. I was just out of my PhD at the time, and we went and collected all studies that simultaneously collected self-reports or estimates of smartphone use, social media use, things like that, as well as they in some way either logged the behavior with an app on someone's phone, or they had APIs where they collected some form of objective data on how much time or how frequently someone had actually used their devices. And long story short, we found that there was a positive correlation between them. So they do trend in the same sort of direction, but the relationship was too weak to actually consider self-reports reliable proxies for logs, which is sort of the idea there that this is not a good substitute. If we want to measure behavior, asking someone how much time do you spend or how frequently do you do something, that's not a very good indication of their actual behavior. We found that participants' estimates were only accurate in about 5% of studies or 5% of included effects in that analysis. So 95% of studies, the relationship was more than 5% out. And that's, of course, a major concern. If the entire body of research is built on having an independent variable that is smartphone behavior or social media time, and that's not being measured very, very well, it does raise questions about the validity of that that evidence base of effects of digital media on mental health or on attention or on well-being and things like that. It's on potentially shaky foundations. And it also highlights, you know, this need for methodological improvements in how we study behavior, in how we study digital media use, to try and understand these types of effects. And something I noticed around the same time, linked to this, was simultaneously that there was a bit of a problem here in the evidence base, but also that there was a problem in how people were communicating about this and how this was coming up in the media, that findings were getting front page headlines, press releases were getting major attention, and almost zero attention was given to the quality of evidence. If something was a cross-sectional survey with 100 people, that was, major headline, social media is destroying your lives, or whatever the case might be. Whereas it might be that people were asked, how long do you typically spend on social media? And that was then related in a correlation with a kind of a scale for well-being or something like that. So I think there's this need for much closer scrutiny and interpretation of the quality of evidence behind a particular effect. And largely, I haven't seen much progress there. That there is a lot of fairly weak evidence informing policy, informing interventions, informing practice, and so on. And to link to the sort of second part of your question there, also linked to this idea is this this idea of the mere presence effect, or the so-called brain drain effect, which essentially is the idea that having a smartphone nearby, even if you don't use it, consumes cognitive resources and can impair task performance. So this sort of kind of brought these two areas together, this sort of measurement quality of evidence, but bringing things back to the attention area of my research at the time. So this brain drain effect, this mere presence effect, there were two seminal studies, one in 2014 that sort of first introduced the idea, but then the main study was in 2017 that really popularized it, got huge media attention. Thousands of articles have picked up this idea, and I think it's fairly well established in the sort of public consciousness that having a phone nearby, you can start thinking about it and you can be distracted by it, and so on. I know it came up in some recent popular science books last year, where fairly unquestioningly this was put forward as a clearly agreed upon sort of scientific finding, informing policy in schools and so on. And again, I sort of thought maybe there's something up here. I'm not sure if this is necessarily the case. So this was in 2022 and 2023. I conducted a meta-analysis on this body of evidence. I went and found, I think there's about 30 studies that have been conducted since the original two studies, to try and see how they replicate the finding. Do we still find this evidence for this brain drain effect? Is working memory or fluid intelligence or inhibitory control impacted, or at least performance on tasks, assessing those abilities, is that impacted by the mere presence of an effect? And my analysis essentially found that the evidence is much weaker than originally claimed. For many of these cognitive domains, the effects were null. There was no strong effects. And where effects were statistically significant, they were much, much weaker. They were almost less than half the size of some of the original studies. So it does suggest that maybe the panic is less of an issue then. What I also found, though, is that across the entire body of research here, we're talking sort of maybe about 30 studies, 60 effects, something like that, statistical power was so low that we could barely actually draw conclusions about the magnitude or the existence of the effect. Most studies tended to involve between 10 and 20 people with 5% statistical power. We're talking really, really weak evidence for or against. And essentially it means that while the mere presence or the brain drain effect has been widely publicized, in popular science books, in press articles and so on, the empirical foundation is essentially entirely uncertain. We actually don't know if it does exist or if it doesn't exist. But meanwhile, it's talked about in the public consciousness. It's talked about in the media, and is in some cases informing policy. So it's, I think, quite a problem here is the quality of our evidence and what that means for what we know, as well as what it means for our ability to inform policy.
Going back to what you said about the self-reporting of research, because that's what you did in when you were asking your students about how much time they spent on their phone, and they didn't realize that actually they spent a lot more time than they thought they did. So in some ways, doing self-reporting research is fine to some degree, but then actually doing a lot more scientific, rigorous research is much better than just me telling you what I think, maybe this is what I did, because our memories are quite bad in terms of our behavior and how much we remember of what we've done. So there's a real breakdown in our perception of what we do. And to take that, the findings from self-reporting research, and make it an absolute for everyone, I think is not really very scientific. It's a great way to kind of say, well, this is a behavior that we need to research, but actually use it as a definitive, it might be a bit too much to ask.
I think it depends what your research question is. If your research question is about perceptions of behavior, which is quite interesting to study in its own right, of course, asking people whether interviews or focus groups or in a survey of some sort, that's interesting to study. And of course, there's some things that you can't study with sort of more objective indicators. I've done a recent paper on something like habits, and whether something was automatic or not is difficult to actually measure kind of with a app log or something like that. You need some degree of self-reporting. So I think it's quite difficult to make a clear black and white sort of always objective data or always self-report data. But in general, I think if you're trying to study behavior, you want your measure to be as close as behavior as possible. So there's many times where I've studied perceptions or I'm studying people's subjective beliefs about their behavior. There, of course, you want self-report, whether it's with an experience sampling method or a survey. But if you're studying their actual actions, the actual behaviors that they perform, then measuring those actions or getting as close as you can possibly measure those actions. Of course, I also am not an advocate to say that these types of logs are free from biases as well. I spent a lot of time working with smartphone tracking data and with various APIs from social media platforms and so on. And there's a lot of factors that can also affect how accurate those are in themselves. But in general, the idea would be if you're studying behavior, measure behavior. If you're studying subjective beliefs, perceptions, thoughts about behavior, things that might affect that, then self-reports are fairly reasonable.
Brilliant. Thanks for clarifying that. That's a good point. If you're studying beliefs, then you do need self-reporting. Absolutely. You've recently moved to the Netherlands from Stellenbosch and now assistant professor at Freie University. What is your role there? What are you doing?
Yes. Last year, I made the move from Stellenbosch University in South Africa to join the Department of Communication Science at Freie Universiteit Amsterdam as an assistant professor in media psychology. And my role is quite varied. I teach bachelor's and master's courses on topics like media entertainment, films, music, parental mediation of children's media use and so on. Media effects, so everything we've talked about, I suppose, in this session around attention, distraction, well-being, things like that, and also around various new media challenges. So they're focusing on master's courses on media literacy and social media literacy and so on. I also supervise theses, particularly those focusing on things like digital distraction, using experimental designs and digital trace data methods to actually measure behavior. And alongside this, of course, I conduct research with colleagues at the FOO and my broader network of collaborators around the world.
And you do a lot of research. From your master's to your PhD and then post that. And so a lot of your time is spent researching media psychology or cyber psychology issues. So what kind of research are you planning on focusing on going forward over the next few years?
Yeah, my interests are quite varied. I've obviously got a bit of a methodological measurement interest. I am interested in media effects in relation to well-being, mental health. It's, of course, a very, very topical issue, all around the world, as well as then, of course, I'm going to continue working on things like distraction and attention and self-control. And I think over the next few years, my plans are to continue focusing on digital self-control tools and studying digital distraction, particularly this idea of sustained effects. I think a lot of what has been conducted over the last 10 years, it's difficult to trust what that actually means. So I've got a few projects on the go looking at developing some new theories around trying to understand this. And then, of course, extending from those is different empirical designs to go and test those theories. I'm also contributing to the development of tools and infrastructure to actually support measuring mobile media use more effectively. Not only better tools, but also sort of democratizing those tools. I think there's this increasing push for more computational research in media psychology, in communication science. And I'm, of course, part of that with my more computational background. But I also believe that there are people who don't have computational skills who need to be able to use these types of tools, whether that's simulated social media environments or smartphone tracking tools or large language models, whatever the techniques might be. So I'm hoping in various ways to work towards developing tools, but also making them more accessible to a broader set of researchers. And then I also recently heard just a few days ago that I was part of a successful grant application with a team of collaborators in London, Amsterdam, and Jakarta to study digital well-being and digital literacy among youth in India, Indonesia, Vietnam, and South Africa. So this this project will hopefully be a major focus over the coming years, because while there's lots of attention on digital well-being and digital literacies and all these types of questions in the global north, there's much less research resources and attention on these issues in the global south. So alongside developing measures and tools and methods, and alongside focusing on more foundational research on attention and distraction, I hope to contribute to this work amongst young people in these four global south countries.
Because those are really countries that haven't been researched all that much, and there's been a smattering of research around digital literacy in kind of non-global north Western countries, but this is sounds like a really exciting project, and I'd love to find out more about that when you are further on in the process of doing research. What kind of opportunities for someone coming into media psychology or cyber psychology, what kind of opportunities do you think that they have in terms of if they want to pursue a career in this field?
Well, at Freie Universität, media psychology is essentially one of the groups within our Department of Communication Science. We've got another group on digital communication, which is closely linked, and then a third group on political communication and computational methods. And we've got leading scholars on areas like social robotics, which is obviously a growing area there of human-machine communication there, health communication, media narratives, and so on. But then there's also a lot of expertise around VR and AR, which of course is also a growing area of interest, things like privacy, political communication, and then using large language models and various computational methods to study whether it's news, journalism, communication online, and so on. So it's a great environment where there's lots of opportunities, either as a bachelor's student, a master's student, PhD openings, postdocs, things like that. We're always looking for talented masters and PhD students, postdocs, also collaborators, whether in academia, of course, that's great to work alongside people in academia, but also in industry. We've got a number of people within the department who regularly work with companies like KLM or other small or large companies, because I think a lot of these phenomena don't only take place at home or amongst individuals. A lot of these phenomena, especially things like distraction, I'm sitting here on a laptop, you're probably also on a computer. We can study these in companies, but we do need to partner with companies, to partner with individuals within corporations to actually get a better idea of what's going on there. And I guess now that this comes up, this is also another area that I am hoping to at least in some way move a little bit more into, is studying these same questions, digital distraction, digital well-being, not only amongst youth. I think that's certainly important and certainly something that I'll continue doing, but also amongst working professionals. There's a bit more of a gap here amongst this population. A lot less we understand about burnout, stress, the blurring of work-home boundaries, of boundary spanning, things like that, of fragmented smartphone or laptop use. If I'm in Zoom, I'm on I'm writing some software, I've got my browser open, I've got different documents going on. There's a lot of task switching, a lot of switching between your family, personal life on WhatsApp and work life and so on. So there's a lot of hope that we can study this, but we do need companies to partner with us and so on to give us access to data, or to at least individuals. So that's something that myself and a number of people at Freie Universität are looking to develop more understanding of working professionals, mental health and well-being and distraction in relation to digital technologies.
And I think that what you kind of touched on it right in the beginning of your of this part of the answer to the question, and I think there's a lot of work that's, especially in Europe, that's being done around social robotics, VR, AR, and AI, really, and how we are actually the impact, psychological and behavioral impact of these new forms of technology that's coming into the public domain rather than just in a very specialized area of work or industry. And we're now using it more as individuals, as consumers. So we are going to start seeing that some kind of impact on our psychology and our behavior going forward. So it's a really great area to start researching. And you spoke earlier on, right in the beginning, about usability testing. So that's something that, especially as psychologists, this is really a great area to get involved in.
Yeah, and I hope that with some of these new technologies or newer developments coming into the public domain, I hope that we can maybe be a little bit more prepared as academics than maybe we have been with something like social media, where social media has been around for 10, 15 years. Of course, it's changed as we spoke about, but I do feel that some of these questions that we're now being asked to answer in front of, you know, parliaments or schools or things like that, we don't have the proper evidence base. I'm hoping with areas like AR, VR, and AI and so on, that we can at least maybe be a little bit up in front or at least alongside the wave to be better prepared to actually understand what's going on here. But we'll see, I guess, how that plays out.
We're coming to the end of the podcast episode, and I normally have some standard questions I ask all my guests. And the first one is, what is the most important question I haven't asked you yet?
I think we've covered a lot of ground. I think maybe a question that hasn't come up is, you know, why am I doing this? What's the bigger picture? Or, you know, what's my goal behind my research? And I think, sort of, if I take it back to where I started there, talking about my sort of high school experience, which was very, very tech forward. You know, we had, from, I think it was age 14, we had laptops in our classes and smart boards and tablets and so on, long before that was fairly common. This is 20 years ago, I suppose. And so I sort of grew up surrounded by technologies. I was a super early adopter of something like Facebook, probably before I was even allowed to use it, and different things like that. So for me, technology has always been part of my life. I had my first computer at age 5 or 6, my sort of grandpa's old Windows 95 computer or something like that. So technology has always been a part of my life, part of my who I am, and I feel that I've mostly benefited from this huge exposure to technology. And one of the, you know, broader questions that I have is sort of, how can we design and use and engage with these digital technologies in ways that actually do benefit us and do enhance our lives, rather than that are undermining or distracting or negatively impacting our well-being or our mental health. So I'm sort of constantly trying to understand how people use technology and how that can be used in positive ways for them. Of course, that involves understanding the methods and measures. It involves understanding potential negative effects. But generally, I'm trying to foster or help more people have a positive relationship with their technologies.
And then going back to something you spoke about earlier around media taking research findings that might just not have really strong empirical evidence, and taking those findings and kind of sensationalizing them in order to get clickbait and get more eyes on the screen or getting more people into their media channel so that they can get obviously more advertising spend. So do you think that the media is getting better or worse at accurately representing sound academic findings?
Yeah, I think we are in this attention economy where clicks sell, where we need people to click on fairly sensationalized headlines, fairly sensationalized articles. I remember, I think I was a master's student and I had a paper that got featured in the newspaper at some point with a headline, like, phones make you dumb, something like that, a very, very over the top headline. And I think in general, I'm quite disappointed actually with how the media handles academic findings, particularly when it comes to important topics like the effects of social media. I've experienced it too often as the academic author or as a bystander, I guess, seeing journalists simply repeat what's in a press release or what's in an article or a book or something like that without actually critically engaging with the underlying evidence, as I mentioned earlier there. I've seen a lot of sort of this absence of journalistic pushback to understand the nuances of a study's methodology or the quality of evidence or what are the boundaries of what this study can say versus that study. And I think as someone who's done quite a few meta-analyses, I also realized the sort of impact of any one individual study is quite small until you actually include it in a meta-analysis, potentially, where you can then see in the larger body of work, you've got some studies finding this type of effect, some studies finding null effect, some studies over here. And really only once you've got enough studies on any kind of question can you actually say the effect is X, the effect is Y. Any one study, there's a huge amount of heterogeneity around those different effects there. So I think I'm disappointed, I guess, in this kind of lack of journalistic pushback. And I think it can have major consequences. These, you know, sensationalist claims, especially those that kind of align with pre-existing narratives or some say moral panics or ideas about what effects might be, they get front page attention. Whereas, you know, more measured, more nuanced interpretations are often pushed to less prominent spaces. I've seen that before where I've had the press officer has written a fairly sort of catchy headline or title there. And I push back and say, look, the study actually found this. It actually found this, and we can't make that type of claim. And we go from being sort of front or second page, you know, to the back of the newspaper or something like that. And it's not just disappointing. I think it's actually quite damaging. It can foster these negative narratives. It can foster, you know, moral panics. If we talk about the kind of the well-being context here around digital technology, and as we've seen in the last sort of 15 months, it can create fear-based policies or interventions that don't address underlying issues. You know, misleading the public, misleading policymakers, other researchers, and so on. You're making it believe that the science is settled, where I think in many cases with digital media effects, the science is not settled. The evidence is often mixed. It's often context dependent. It's often quite still developing. There's many things that we don't know. And I think it's easy to maybe scapegoat and say, well, it's the journalist's problem. I do think there is some responsibility there on journalists to push back on things, to criticize and look at the quality of evidence. But there is some responsibility on academics as well. I think, you know, we need to communicate our findings fairly clearly. We need to, you know, resist oversimplifying just for the sake of attention. Of course, that is potentially difficult. And we need to push back against, you know, the misuse or misrepresentation of our own work. And I'm not sure if it's gotten worse. I think it's always been fraught with challenges. I think in the last, you know, 10, 15 years, there is this attention economy. There is this need for headlines, this need for clicks, this need for time on websites and so on. And that's the world that we're living in. But I think figuring out journalists from the journalistic side and academics from the academic communication side, how we can communicate uncertainty, how we can communicate a degree of ambiguity. It was a project I never actually finished, but I started looking in the pandemic around this idea of ambiguity aversion, where in many cases the public is averse to people not having clear stances on something, or not having the effect is X or the effect is Y. And then you often find that people who have very strong, clear opinions get a lot more attention, a lot more clicks. We were investigating this in the context of COVID-19 and the pandemic and communication on Twitter, trying to understand academics who are saying, well, we don't know, or the evidence is mixed, or it may be this, or it may be that, versus people who are much more clear in their communication, that it is definitely this, it is definitely that, and so on. So figuring out as academics how to communicate uncertainty and ambiguity is not going to be easy, but it's something that we do need to get better at. But then also on the side of journalists to push back, to be more critical of what's coming out of academia.
I wonder if there's two things from that perspective. The one about journalists, that they under so much pressure to shunt out as many articles as possible, because it is an information industry, that you've kind of got to get as many articles out there, because the more articles you throw at media or at social media, the more opportunity there is of actually getting that clickbait and getting people to come to your platform. And I wonder also with the consumers generally, is that we're looking often for quick fix solutions. We just don't have time to go down the, well, maybe this, maybe that. And we don't have time to do all the background research. So we want an expert to give us that quick fix solution. So the quick fix solution is, here's a scapegoat of a social media channel or a phone. So let's just go with that, because that's easiest. It's kind of the easiest way to actually get to the point that I want to get to, which is I want to fix this quickly.
And I can see that as a I can understand the idea of also an academic might say, oh, well, the science is not settled, we don't know, we're conducting research, let's wait 5 years and see what happens. And a parent might say, well, that's all good and well, but my child is 15 now. When they're 20, it's too late. So I can understand both sides of that story. And I think finding that balance between informing policy now in this uncertain context, communicating science effectively, communicating nuance, ambiguity, and then also pushback from the journalist, finding that balance is not easy, but that's something where I hope we can move a little bit more in that direction.
Yeah, and I agree with you. It's up to academics to really get the research out there, because often we publish academic findings in academic journals, which you have to go through a paywall to find, and there's often academic language. And so it's very difficult for the general consumer to find that information other than on generic mass media. So it is our responsibility as well to get it out there.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And a lot of research findings, as you say, they're put behind a paywall. They're only read either never, or they're only read by other academics, and it's not accessible to the public. And even if it if it was accessible to the public, I'm not sure how many people want to go read a 10,000 word article with all the stats and so on any particular effect to communicate and disseminate and share and translate academic findings from the academic world into the public domain is certainly a challenge.
We've got a lot of work to do as academics and cyber psychologists, new year psychologists, to get that information out there and get a more balanced view and help people with solutions or kind of think about the media headlines that are coming through to us and the sensationalized stuff. Douglas, do you have any favorite media psychology or cyber psychology related books that you're normally recommended to others to read?
Yeah, I think maybe linking to this idea of good science communication, Pete Etchell's book, Unlocked the Real Science of Screen Time and How to Spend It Better, is probably the book that I would recommend at the moment. It's the book that I would read at the moment if you haven't. It does a great job of cutting through the hype, cutting through the panic and so on, and considering the actual evidence quality. What do we actually know about certain questions around well-being, around distraction, around screen time and media use, sort of more generally? He does a great job of bringing this evidence to light and, rather than panic, sort of advocating for a bit of a paradigm shift towards screen engagement rather than the quantity. I think all too often, a lot of the narratives in the media are about, well, screen time, the amount of time you're doing something. But of course, spending time on Zoom, spending time, working on a laptop or on Instagram, it's all totally different things. And the context in which you're doing these things, if I come home and I'm tired at the end of the day, I spend 10 minutes scrolling on TikTok, that's not necessarily a bad thing. But if I spend minutes scrolling on TikTok while I'm in a class, that's not a good thing. So Pete tries to bring a lot of this sort of nuance around focusing more on the quality of actions than the quantity, and looking at the quality of the evidence that we have there, and developing a bit more of an evidence-based understanding of what is actually going on here, rather than sensationalizing things. So that would be my main sort of cyber psychology, media psychology recommendation book at the moment. And I think if I remember correctly, it's just won a BPS cyber psychology or BPS British Psychological Society Book of the Year award recently. So it's a strong recommendation for me.
Yeah, it's a brilliant book. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I'm still kind of going through it again and again, because there's so much evidence, and he takes scientific research and presents a really clear, balanced view of cyber psychology related stuff. So I agree with you. It's a phenomenal book to read. Douglas, thank you so much for joining me on Confessions of a Cyber Psychologist. It's been so great catching up with you and finding out about your research that you've done and the research you're doing. And I'd love to chat to you again in the future about your research that you're doing on the grant that you've just won, and kind of looking at the eastern and southern side of the world population and how they're interacting with media and the implications there.
Definitely. Thanks for having me on board.